You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. What are our most important recent decisions? How would our founding fathers view them? What happens when a new Supreme Court justice needs to be appointed? Can a non-lawyer serve on the Supreme Court? Henry J. Abraham, James Hart Professor of Government Emeritus at the University of Virginia, graduated from Kenyon College in 1948 with a bachelor's degree in political science, first in his class, summa cum laude, and Phi Beta Kappa. He earned his M.A. in public law and government from Columbia University in 1949 and received his Ph.D. in political science from the University of Pennsylvania in 1952, where he began his teaching career. In 1972, Dr. Abraham became a chaired professor in the Department of Government and Foreign Affairs at the University of Virginia. In 1983, he was awarded the university's most prestigious recognition, the Thomas Jefferson Award, and in 1993, he received the first Lifetime Achievement Award of the Organized Section on Law and Courts of the American Political Science Association. He retired from full-time teaching in 1997 after nearly half a century in the classroom. Mr. Abraham spoke at the Wednesday, November 13, 2013 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Charles Smith. Our podcast is entitled Reflections on the Supreme Court. Here's Charles Smith.
Henry Abraham. He was born in Germany back in the 1920s. And when he was 15 years of age, he moved from Germany, immigrated from Germany to the United States. A couple of years later, his father and his mother and his brother came over to the United States as well. And they first had contacts in New Orleans, and then they had settled in for Pittsburgh for a long period of time. He went to Kenyon College. I think you did that after you went into military service, did you not? Yeah. Yeah. After the military service. Kenyon College, graduated from there, top of the class, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa. I mean, you mentioned it. He got it. And the next time he went to Columbia and got his master's degree, and then he went on to, these are in government and law, and this type of thing that ended him up to where he is today with the Supreme Court. He's written, when he got his master's degree at Columbia, then he went on to Pennsylvania, got his Ph.D., and you worked in Pennsylvania for a few years and came here around 1972, if I remember correctly. Is that about right?
No, but that's how I
told you I didn't bring my notes. What year was it? And I think this is a very good time for me to stop. I will say he wrote 13 books, hundreds of articles that he's written. He also co-authored a book recently with the one of your books that you've written on the Supreme Court and civil liberties with our good friend Barbara Perry, who's yes. going to be speaking here with the Senior Statesman of Virginia on June of this coming year. So we'll have a successor to you to come here to talk about her recent book on Rose Kennedy. So that's it. I won't say anything more.
Thank you very much for being here. I hope you can hear me. I see a lot of good friends in the audience who have heard me many times. And they may leave at any moment if it becomes too repetitious. I want to thank Mrs. Lieberman and her staff for providing me with an excellent lunch and a very pleasant and comrade-like atmosphere. I've come to speak to you about various aspects of my favorite branch of the government. And if we have enough time, I may give you the reasons why I regard it as my favorite branch. Whether or not that's important, one thing is clear, that the court represents the choice of more Americans than any of the other branches in existence. That may not be saying a great deal sometimes, but it is. The court is usually 10 to 20 percentage points ahead. At the moment, the court has suffered some reverses in the public eye because of the Citizens United case and the Obama case, but that comes along with the territory. In second place is the executive, who is not in such great shape at the moment either. And in third place, right along with unions and gravel, is Congress. That's their most recent percentage is 9 or 10 in the public esteem. So, sorry, Jim, that's all I do. Okay. So I've come to talk to you a little bit about the Supreme Court of the United States. I was always fascinated by it, and I soon, during my educational career, began to be really mesmerized by the court. I should also tell you that I'm not a lawyer. I'm a fake. I taught law for almost 60 years, but it was mostly one kind of law. The right kind. No, I don't mean that. It was constitutional law. But I don't have a shingle, as the lawyers would tell you very quickly. So my impressions are really more from the point of view of the governmental process and, if you wish, the political process. In any event, there are certain basics, and many of you have heard me before. I see a lot of familiar faces who have been in my classes, and in fact, I'm teaching a class tomorrow. It's going to be my ultimate one, and I've enjoyed doing it very much. There are certain basics that many of you have heard me pronounce upon, which I want to reiterate. One is, there are two very significant aspects or concepts of the court's position under the Constitution of the United States, which is embedded in this lovely little book. This is Justice Black's favorite Constitution issue. He's buried with it. It cost 10 cents when he was buried in 1971. Everything is in here, and he annotated it usually, and he abided by it pretty much. He was a literalist and an absolutist. He wanted to go back to the words. And there are people on the court nowadays who are also absolutists and literalists. One of them is Justice Scalia, who goes to this all the time. If it doesn't fit, he'll sometimes adjust it. But the point is, it is an important document. Now, those two significant aspects are, one, who is on the court? That is very, very important. It is absolutely vital who's on the court. You don't have to be a lawyer to be on the court, but no one ever has been on the court who did not have a law degree or was not taught by people in the law. But otherwise, and of course, fortunately, the court is not elected. Some states elect their judges. I think that's an aberration and should be stopped, but it won't be. The court is appointed, as you know, is nominated by the president, approved by the Senate, and then the court is there for life. That's not what the Constitution says. It uses the terminology good behavior. Only one Supreme Court justice has ever been impeached. We have had 112, and the one who's been impeached was not convicted, however. He had a very big mouth, and he spent most of his time criticizing Mr. Jefferson, you see. But he was a good jurist. It just, as I say, he was just very... He had a good time. Fortunately, he was not convicted, but he had been impeached. His name was Chase, Samuel Chase. There was another Chase later on in the 1860s. So who is on the court is extremely important, and I can say a few things about the members of the court in a little while. Now, I find four major reasons why presidents select people for the judiciary in general and the Supreme Court in particular. The first one, thank God, is merit. That is central and significant. It's not always done, but merit is the cardinal reason why people are selected. On the whole, I would say that we've done pretty well with the Supreme Court. I would give them a B+ or an A-. And so Mr. Madison's hope that the Supreme Court would be happily fulfilled by having people who do well by the country has become reality. By and large, they've been quite good. We've had some clinkers, and we always will have, but not too many, actually. I happen to be teaching a course this year called Great Justices of the Supreme Court. I've only found about six whom I would call as radical failures. The others were all over. 12 of those are normally regarded as giants and would be called great justices. That varies, of course, and perhaps we can get into that to a little bit to some extent. Anyway, merit is a cardinal reason for presidential selection. A second one, of course, would be political and personal friendship. You can bracket that in one. Frequently, presidents will select people because they're politically comfortable with them or because they're good friends. President Johnson wanted Abe Fortas on the court, and so he managed to get Justice Goldberg off the court. How he did it, we all know. He did it by good arm twisting. Why Goldberg complied, I couldn't say. I've asked him, and he said to me, "Well, have you ever had your arm twisted by President Johnson?" And I said, "Well, with all due respect," I still called him, of course, Justice Goldberg, "with all due respect, Justice Goldberg, you were not appointed by President Johnson. You were appointed by President Kennedy." And he said, "Yes, I know. And I'm going to repeat my question. Have you ever had your arms twisted?" And I shook my head, and he walked away from me, and I was no longer a reasonable questioner. In any event, a third reason would be, of course, an obvious one, namely, a person's real politics. That is very significant, you see. It doesn't have to be a nominal politics or anything approaching it. Whatever is the individual's real politics counts significantly. That, of course, is where the cardinal search for people who will do well will arrive. President George Bush interviewed five people for the positions had opened, resulted ultimately in Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. President Obama had two choices, as you know. They were both nominated for any number of reasons. They were bright, they were capable, they were liberal, they were women. And incidentally, the three women on the court usually vote together. Not because they're women, but because they're ideologically very much at home with one another. That will probably continue. There have been very few dissenting voices among the women in various cases. The only one who once or twice left the reservation is Justice Sotomayor, but she was at one time a member of the executive branch, and she was a prosecutor for a while. She's done very well. She just announced that she sold 3 million copies of her book. It's a marvelous book. It's too long, but it is marvelous. And it is a fantastic story of her life, which...
You mean Justice Kagan?
No, I know it's Sotomayor.
No, she was in the executive branch. She worked for the president.
Sotomayor was a prosecutor, not on the federal level. On the state level. Kagan had several positions, yes. Kagan was a solicitor general. She was also dean of the Harvard Law School. She wanted to be president of the Harvard Law School. She did not get that. She will conceivably become chief justice sometime. She is very young. You may not think that's young, but I'm 92. So 53 is pretty damn young, you know. So this is what... A few of you here, I think, are probably that age. Not too many, but there's some anyway. So that was the third reason for presidential selection. And the fourth reason is a very controversial one, which has become very much in vogue, namely the notion of representativeness, namely that members of the court should somehow be representative of various elements in the public wheel. In other words, such as they ought to be representative of sex or gender, whichever you want to call, of liberalism or conservatism, any number of considerations which could conceivably play a role. That has been very controversial because it has often approached notions and concepts of quotas, you see, which of course you all know about in connection with the whole issue of affirmative action. It's very much a reason why people are appointed nowadays and will probably continue to be. Whether or not that should be is a different story. I would have to give you another lecture on that issue. But it's those, these four are the basic reasons why the court is what it is. The members, we have had 112 members, as I said, and these members are usually people who have some kind of public connection. They are, of course, all have their law degrees. They're all highly capable, and they're all ready to do their bit. It's if you look at them now, at the present time, the current court's a pretty good court. It's not a great court, maybe, but it's a good court, certainly okay. The Chief Justice is, of course, in its central position. He is primus inter pares, first among equals. He has no more power than any of the others, except for one important power, and that is he assigns cases. But he usually tries very hard to give roughly the same number of cases to all of them. And sometimes they're eager to get cases, sometimes they're not. He tries to accommodate them. Sometimes they don't want to write opinions. My favorite example, of which some of you have me talk about on a number of occasions, was a justice by the name of Whitaker. If you've never heard of him, you haven't missed anything. He was, unfortunately, an Eisenhower appointee. Eisenhower picked some very good people. Charlie Whitaker came out of the corporate world where he was very happy, and he took that position on the Supreme Court, as almost anybody would. There are not many who say no. There's some who said no. Sometimes they change their mind. Justice Powell said no 3 times, and Justice Forder said no about 15 times, and his wife added another 25 why he shouldn't take it, because they weren't going to make as much money as they were making outside. But it's a fascinating situation, of course, and the Chief Justice is at the head. And one of these members of the court, whom I just mentioned, Justice Whitaker, appointed by Eisenhower, had only written 4 or 5 opinions. The court was halfway through, and Chief Justice Warren began to worry about the man he called Chuck or Chucky. Anyway, Chuck didn't want to write any opinions, and he did everything under the sun not to do so. One day, Chief Justice Warren had something for him, and he said, "Chuck, I got a case for you. This you've got to write. It's a majority opinion. It's not very complicated. You've got to do it." "No, sir, I don't want to do that," Earl, or whatever he called him. Warren said, "You're going to do it, you see, as long as we're sitting here until you say yes." Finally, he said yes, and he was miserable. So he didn't know what to do. Then he thought, oh boy, there's anyone who can write all kinds of cases, and anyone who is a fast writer, it is Bill Douglas. William O. Douglas, one of the great liberal members of the court, married 4 times. And the last time, he married a 24-year-old girl, Kathy Heffernan of Washington. He was 75. They were married, and the following day, he already had another assignation. He just wanted to keep up to date. In any event, Mr. Whitaker went to see Justice Douglas and said, "You got to help me, please, Bill." And Douglas said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "Well, I can't write this case, and I have to because the chief's going to kill me." And Douglas said, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And Whitaker said, "Well, how about writing the majority opinion in that case, because that's been assigned to me." And Douglas said, "Well, of course, I can do that for you. I can do it pretty quickly. But there's a problem. I've already written the dissenting opinion in the case." This is I'm not embellishing anything. That's the case. And Whitaker said, so what do we do? And Douglas said, well, you come back in an hour. I'll write the majority opinion, and my dissenting opinion stands. So this is the only time in the history of the Supreme Court that a justice wrote both the majority opinion and the dissenting opinion in a case. And I hope he had a ball. He probably did. Well, it does matter who is on the court. This is a pretty decent court. Ideologically, they're divided, I would say, 4-4. And there is, in the middle, there is Kennedy, Antonin Kennedy. Kennedy is basically a conservative, but he is happiest in the middle, and he likes to write opinions, but only if he can do it the way he wants to do it. He doesn't ask many questions of the justices, but he's all ears. He has a little heart problem, but I think he's reasonably good shape. In any event, he's in the middle, and he's very comfortable there. When you see 5-4 opinions, just look and see where he stands, because he likes to write these opinions. He likes to win above all. He is a key figure, especially in social-type cases. The fourth, more or less conservatives, are the Chief Justice, Justice Alito, Justice Scalia, and Justice Thomas. The four avowed liberals are the three women. Justice Ginsburg is the oldest and the most liberal of the four so far. She's 80 now, is not well, but she's going to stay up there as long as she can. And no matter what people wanted to step down, so the president will get another chance. She told the president, don't talk to me about who's the appointing. I'm on the court. I'm not retiring this year. I don't know next year, and I don't know but the year after. Anyway, her colleagues are Sotomayor. She's been on the court for 5 years, and she's pretty young too. She's 59, and the third one is Kagan. She has a great future. She writes beautifully. She's very predictable, and a true blue liberal, writes beautifully, and is the only one who did not have judicial experience. The one with most judicial experience on the court is Justice Sotomayor. She had 17 years. And Justice Alito had 15 years. He's the only member of the court who was in the military for 5 years, I think in the Signal Corps. I was in that for a while. That wasn't much of a military unit, but anyway, it was in the Army, more or less. So those are the four. Oh, I forgot the only man on the liberal side, excuse me. That is the professor on the court. He's a lawyer. That is Breyer, Stephen Breyer, who likes to talk. And when he begins to talk, he takes his right arm and puts it on his head. And we all know a big speech is coming, you see. So we either turn off whatever we were listening to in the stands or what. He likes to write, and he's a close collaborator, at least speaking as a colleague, with Justice Thomas. Not jurisprudentially, but of course they sit next to each other, and they sometimes play tic-tac-toe on the bench, and sometimes they yawn together. But in any way, they all get along, I might tell you, by the way. Many people think they have a great deal of strife on the court. No, the strife is embedded in the cases, and that is obvious. But personally, socially, they're all together. A very famous team of close friends was a very unlikely one: Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg and her husband, she had a very good marriage for many, many years, were close friends of Mrs. Scalia and Justice Scalia. They often met Saturday evenings at the Watergate and would have dinner. The men cooked and the women cleaned up. So you can remember that. In any event, they do get along. Of the conservatives, the most conservative probably is Justice Alito, although Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas are very close. The least among them, I've already mentioned Kennedy, who belongs on that side, but they, as I said, they get along, They're all talented, and it's a fairly decent court. Now, I have to say one thing about Justice Thomas. He's often, of course, very quiet. In fact, he's usually quiet. He yawns and he leans back in his chair, but he's done his work, we have to assume. And if you were to ask him, why don't you ask any questions? He's asked 3 questions in 14 years. I happened to hear 2 of them. One was on an affirmative action case from which he benefited, and he voted to strike it down, you see, but that's a different story. Another one was the KKK law in Virginia, which forbade the burning of crosses. But the legislature did not distinguish between public burning and private burning. And Thomas said, that you can't do. Under the First Amendment, you can privately burn crosses if you want to, as long as it is on your lawn. But you can't burn the crosses in the middle of the street. That would be public. So these are thumbnail sketches of the justices. As I said, they do a great deal together, and they get along. Now, their role, of course, is enormously significant. They're very powerful people. The Supreme Court of the United States, in many ways, is probably the most powerful branch. They can have influence far exceeding that of the other two branches. They don't always exercise it, but they can do so. And because of that, you have to recognize that this is very much of a major branch of the government. It is in third place. It's Article 3 that governs it, but it is powerful. And normally the public is satisfied with what the court does. Not always, and there are instances which you can name. But on the whole, the public has more faith in the court than it does in the other two branches. Now, that I put under I said there are 2 major concepts which you have to recognize. First one, who is on the court and what they do. The second one is, of course, their perception of the judicial role, which gives us the line between judicial activism and judicial restraint. That is a very important consideration. Namely, justices, of course, have the case in front. They have the Constitution. They're supposed to lay one next to the other. Sometimes justices will go beyond what they see and hear. Sometimes they want to provide a little help to the legislature, which God knows they may need. Among other things, they've forgotten the noun compromise or the verb to compromise. Be that as it may, the justices, you know, have to be cognizant of that famous line between legislating on the court and between acting on the court in their judicial capacity. Some justices would rather legislate on the court than others. There's some very famous one. One of the supreme legislators on the court was a man who, I'm happy to say, was a friend of mine. I had his daughter in class. That was Justice Brennan, who was on the bench for 34 years. Justice Brennan was not bothered by verbiage. He was legislating on the bench, you see. That is why he could never be considered, from my point of view, as a great justice. He was a great man. He was wonderful to me. We were first-name friends. But he went way beyond the tasks a Supreme Court justice should embrace. So there were others like it. Sometimes Justice Powell did, but not quite as much. Justice Powell wanted to do well. He was a centrist. He was a wonderful human being. But I've already indicated to you that he asked strange questions sometimes, and he was not beyond asking questions which seemed to be obvious. But when it came to morality and ethics and being a terrific person, he was it. And he was one of many Virginians we had on the bench. He wrote the Bakke case, and he wrote several other significant ones. Now, how to draw that line between activism and Jurisprudentialism is a very difficult one. It's initially, instantly up to the individual jurors. They would all say we find it in the Constitution. And there are phrases in the Constitution which explain to you why the court so frequently seems to be out of bounds. One phrase is equal protection of the laws. That is an open sesame in terms of your response to it and the justice's response up to a point. The other one is maybe even more so. That's the due process clause, you see. Neither the states nor the federal government may abridge without due process life, liberty, and property. Life, you know, that's capital punishment. That's a whole other issue and a very interesting one and an exceedingly alive one. Liberty, well, you may have to go to jail. You know, the Constitution permits it. But the state or the federal government must have justification for it. And now property, well, in a few months you're going to be deprived of property with due process of law, right? That's April the 15th when you pay your taxes. That is deprivation of your property, but with due process of law, because the IRS is an organization established by Congress and will provide rules based upon the legislative process. So when you have phrases like those two, you're really opening the door wide for that specific area of the court's function, which I regard as the area that should be most closely examined. How do they perceive that famous role? How do they perceive their justification for doing what they are doing based upon the views present either implicitly or explicitly in the Constitution? There's one other consideration which actually during the past few years has become of more concern to me, of more interest, and that is the Chief Justices in particular have a responsibility. They have no more power than do the others, but they are number one. They're primus inter pares, they're first among equals, but there they are. Well, there is a twofold approach to the proper interpretation of the judicial role. One is called the jurisprudential role. That is when the justices look at the law, look at the Constitution, and base their judgments on that. The other one is an institutional perception under which the justices try to save the position that the court has and try to convince the country that what they're doing is necessary, even if it doesn't seem to make much sense. We've had some very interesting illustrations of the latter one not so long ago. We had it in the case of the so-called Obamacare case, which, as you know, was decided 5-4 to uphold that strange piece of legislation. In any event, the Chief Justice's background and his whole perception would have probably wanted him to strike down what Congress did with that very strange law that was enacted and with which some of you are having a good time or not such a good time, depending upon the point of view. But he did not want a repetition of the brouhaha that surrounded Bush v. Gore, the 2000 election, you know. I'm not criticizing that at all. In fact, I would give you an interpretation which some of you might not like. But this institutional approach played a big role in Chief Justice Roberts' great effort to somehow save the law because he didn't want a repetition of the public outcry of Bush v. Gore, which really wasn't such a difficult case. The way I teach it is I look at the reasoning of the Florida Supreme Court, which violated two provisions of the United States Constitution. That's all I needed to see. But of course, other people saw a great deal more. So Roberts was determined not to have that same sort of business again. And so, as he read the case, it was broadcast, you may remember, first he looked at the commerce power, Well, that's not interstate commerce, you know. I've been teaching that forever. That's not interstate commerce, nor is it intercourse state commerce, as one of my students put on his paper. But that's a different story. So it was not 183, that's the Constitution provision of interstate commerce. So he said, that has to be struck down. And I was sitting there listening and said, oh boy, maybe I'm going to win this one. Next came sort of a general approach to the responsibilities of the legislature. That was all right, too. Then, however, came the very, very interesting and highly criticized judgment, namely that the law could stand by virtue of a tax which would be leveled upon individuals involved in this new law. That was no tax, ladies and gentlemen. That was a penalty. That was a fee. However, five votes are more than four, as Justice Scalia always tells me when I raise a question, you see. So that is what he wanted. And since that time, he's been trying to make up for it, you see, in some of his decisions. So you have the jurisprudential responsibility, and then you have the institutional responsibility. All right. One other major basic issue that I'd like to at least point out for you is the court manifests a trifold institutional character. It is a unit of government, right? It governs. It is a unit of government. It has a constitutional provision in Article 3, all right? That's one. It is a legal institution. It deals with the law. And finally, it is a political institution, not in terms of war politics, but it is its politics come in with the judgment they render when they come to decide whether or not a certain legislative and executive function can stand. That is, of course, the decision that I've already alluded to several times. Now, that embrace is a trifold one, and you can think of it in that fashion. The court manifests these powers and these characteristics, and that is basically what it does. Now, what about the court's general position? What is its constitutional authority? Well, it is a completely created constitutional authority, and we have to thank one gentleman on the bench for that creation. He is the only justice on the Supreme Court who received all of the 65 votes of the professionals who were asked professionally to rank the justices on the Supreme Court. That happened in 1969 and 70. I was one of the 65. I was very happy. I guess the Political Science Association put me on there. There were 65 of us. We were given no criteria at all. We were told we could do what we wanted, except the orders were you've got to pick some people from the 19th century. You can't have them all in the 20th century, which would have been easier, you see. The other thing we were told, no more than 12 can you list. At the most, we recognize 12 greats, you see. So with all that, all 65 voted on the first round. There was only one justice who received all 65 votes as great. We were given great, near great, average, below average, and failures. We were not given anything else. We had no instructions. All right. Who do you think was the one justice who received all 65 votes? John Marshall, of course. He really transformed the Constitution into an operative tool. He gave us, among other things, judicial review. The very important power to do what? Strike down legislation enacted by Congress or the states, or approve legislation handed down by Congress or the states. That judicial review, which he created implicitly and explicitly from the Constitution and also partly out of whole cloth, that provided the hegemony of the Supreme Court in order to slap down the legislature and the executive. The case in which he did that And it was a fascinating case, very convoluted in many ways. It was Marbury versus Madison. All of you remember that name. 1803. And what he did in that case was for the Keystone Cops in some ways. But he got where he wanted to go, to give the court the power of judicial review, which is so highly significant, of course. And the super chief found and articulated the power of judicial review. And ever since that time, laws have been endangered or approved. There have not been many instances of declarations of unconstitutionality in the entire 225 years of the judiciary. The Supreme Court of the United States has struck down only 175 pieces of legislation, either in whole or in part. That's all, you know. That's not even one a year, you see. So that is a power which is there, and they can use it, of course. It is absolutely essential. There's no question about that. And so the 112 men and women on the court can, of course, utilize it when that seems necessary. Now, I ought to tell you, they don't like to do it. They are very, very cautious. They would much rather do something else than strike down a piece of legislation, because that is another coordinate branch of the government. So the present court, you know, is a traditional court. They've struck down very few cases. Justice Ginsburg the other day, sometimes she does too much these days, you know. She said the Roberts Court has struck down more legislation than any other court in the history of the court. She is all wrong, wrong, wrong. This court has struck down fewer cases than any other court since 1953. But she was very eager to get her point of view across. So legislation is at the mercy of the court in a way, but there are rules and there are regulations. I might also point out, which I haven't mentioned when we were talking about appointments to the court, I guess I didn't mention religion, which is one of the reasons, one of the representative notions, you know. The present court is not a characteristic court when it comes to religious representation. How many Protestants are on the present court? Anyone?
None.
There have been 92 Protestants of the 112. There have been 12 Catholics and 8 Jews. The present court has 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. That was unheard of until a few years ago. Now, that doesn't mean that they would vote along religious lines. And it would be wrong, for example, to think that just because you have 6 Catholics, there's going to be a real problem with the abortion issue. They think differently. Justice Brennan, for example, whom, as I said, I knew very well, Justice Brennan went to Mass every day, but he was a proponent of the separation of church and state, you see. So there is a distinction, and that's a movable feast sometime, of course. But it's important to recognize that. On the whole, religion does not play a major role, but they got a new case right now, and they're having a lot of trouble with it. That is the utilization of prayer by public bodies, you see. We have a record on the court of approving it if it wasn't too much Christianity on it, you know. I don't know where you draw the line, whether it's 50% or 94% or whatever. But, you see, that does play a role. And it's interesting because, after all, religion is part and parcel of the so-called representativeness. What they're supposed to represent is, of course, a completely different story. Now, I might, I would stop now for a moment. Are there any questions that you would like to propound?
Thank you very much for being here. And I was wondering, all right, they're going to make me stand up. What do you think will be the decision on Greece, New York, and the public prayer issue?
On which New York?
Greece, New York.
Greece.
Yes.
Well, that's a. I don't know what the. I would like
what
to
you
ask
predict?
Justice Kennedy. He might be able to predict it. We have a good many instances of approval of some kind of quasi-religious utilization in public bodies. We also have some when it went too far. The court, incidentally, about 40 or 50 years ago, the court used to distinguish in religion cases whether or not the creche contained reindeer or not, you see. There was a difference because, I can't give you the citation, I have it in my book, but that made a big difference. Reindeer were apparently regarded as being not a holy animal of some sort. So you had to compose some kind of judgment on that. What they will do, I really don't know. I would have to see exactly how far that particular prayer goes. Reading it doesn't seem to bother me, but, you know, I'm not a good one to ask about religion, you know. I mean, I do what I have to do, but, you know, I don't get too exercised over it. So I can't predict it. It's going to be close unless they find some kind of escape there, you see. So there is a chance that they will uphold it. I think there is a chance they will uphold it. It'll probably lose 3 or 4 votes if it's upheld. If it's struck down, it'll lose maybe 4 votes, you see. So it'll be close, but you never know what they can come up with. So it bothers people a lot, and it bothers others even more. You know, people get very exercised about these things. Sometimes it makes a difference where this religious issue is present, you know. It was a Pittsburgh case, you see. As long as they had a religious manifestation of symbolism in the church or in front of it, it was all right. When they put it up in front of the city hall, it was struck down, you see. So it's really difficult to say. It's a fun parlor game in many ways. Yes.
Citizens United, I'm sorry, I'm Jean Davis, and Citizens United was a very controversial opinion, and people want to know how you can change that through the legislature and what was the reasoning behind it.
Well, the legislature could change it, of course. Citizens United is a very unpopular case. I would have voted against it, you see. It was 5-4, but I'm not on the court, you see. I see nothing wrong with some regulation of political activity, but I have friends and colleagues who think when you interfere with that, you're violating the First Amendment. The First Amendment is an exercise of free expression. So if you want to express yourself by donating $10 million, you see, be my guest. Well, I think there is a justification for some regulation. So far, I don't think the votes are there, and I would suggest, I shouldn't predict anything because it's so difficult to predict. I think not only is it going to be upheld, they're even going to go further, and they're going to allow individuals without any kind of limits. Now we have individual giving limits, you see. Don't be surprised if they'll even go further than that. I think there are 5 votes for that. But that's an I think answer, you see. It is a very unpopular decision, you know, and it's, but there it is. And yes.
I hope when I'm 92, I'm as agile as you. when the president, Obama gave the State of the Union message, he was very upset with the Supreme Court on the ruling that there could be funding for campaigns mm-hmm. from outside. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear your comments on that, especially since our governor's race had so much money from coming in from the outside.
Well, there's a lot of money coming in from the outside. If the president is so unhappy about that, he ought to stop getting money from outside because he's getting it. Yeah, there's nothing criminally wrong with that, you know. But I don't always see the connection between my right of the first under the First Amendment, you know, and regulating campaigns. Some people, First Amendment. This is the most hallowed provision of the Constitutional Bill of Rights, you know. It is, even during the war sometimes, I remember some bull session with fellow soldiers, we would talk about the First Amendment and these, you know, these huge judgments that anything goes. The Germans would probably call it the First Amendment über alles, you see, over everything else. That is a very important issue, the First Amendment issue. I don't think the First Amendment, however, is absolute, although Justice Black said it was. But then he violated it sometimes himself, you see. So that's his privilege, I suppose. So I don't see, I'm afraid, from my point of view, that even going to increase the ability to pay, to support financially.
Just a quick one on Obamacare. I don't want to stretch it out to big discussion. But when the decision was reached, a lot of us were watching television and they announced it's definitely not interstate commerce. So some people in my group cheered. Then the next thing said, it's not really interstate commerce, and you've already said this, but it's a tax. It appears as though if it was presented as a tax, it would have never sold.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so
yes.
The question was changed in my a few of my cohort's opinions, changed because it wouldn't have sold as a tax to the American people. Everybody would have been going berserk. And therefore, you shouldn't change the question. And one follow-up.
Sure.
When the Tavon-Martin...
Can we get to the question?
Oh, the question is...
we have limited time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Tavon-Martin case was decided because apparently the trial counsels did not present the case properly, and they lost. And I always thought at the court system, whenever you presented a case, if you didn't do it right, that's too bad and the other person won. How come when it goes to the Supreme Court could change the question and turn around and tax the American people?
Well, the court can feel that the issue had been so destroyed, had been so obfuscated that the court has to help. You see, and the court will substitute its own judgments. They're not obligated to issue one or the other. They can bring their own judgment based on the Constitution. The fact that it comes up on a different issue or a different part of the Constitution doesn't necessarily make any difference. That doesn't mean that some justices won't write raging dissenting opinions blaming some of their colleagues. You know, they do that anyway frequently. Justice Scalia used to have great fun going after Justice O'Connor, you see, and Justice Ginsburg likes to go after the Chief Justice sometimes. So the court is not obligated to follow certain rules. There are no certain rules. They can start from tabula rasa if they want to, you know. And that case is open and shut case. They could have done more, and they did little. Whether or not we'll have additional litigation in that issue, I don't know. I doubt that the court would be very happy to take it, but it depends, you know.
So the rules of the Supreme Court are slightly different than the normal lower courts.
Well, the Supreme Court, you have to remember, is an appellate court. It is not a trial court. The court has two functions, according to the constitutional verbiage. The court has original jurisdiction when it must take a case or can take a case. Original jurisdiction is limited to two areas in the Constitution. One, when a state is a party. And the way they fudge this is they pick up the case because they have to in original jurisdiction, and then they send it down to the lower courts. They have therefore exercised their original jurisdiction. The another area is any case involving public foreign officers, consuls, ambassadors, and so forth, comes to the Supreme Court as a matter of right. But again, the court can take it and send it down to lower federal courts, not state courts, but lower federal courts. So there are just two areas of original jurisdiction. There are practically no original jurisdiction cases on the record. There's usually one or two a year. An example is Virginia and Maryland steal each other's oyster beds constantly, and the Supreme Court has to come in and try to adjudicate it. That's one area. California, big bully, tries to browbeat Arizona in some other case because of water issues, you see. There again, the court will speak. The court will normally speak. And I'll come to what the court can do in just a minute. So those are the two original areas. Everything else is appellate. And before you can get a case into the Supreme Court, you must exhaust all remedies below. And, of course, you must have standing to sue, S-T-A-N-D-I-N-G, which simply means you must be directly involved. No one else can do it for you, you see, although it may seem that way sometime. When the ACLU, for example, takes a case for a lot of people, well, they can pick any one of the so-called lot of people and utilize that particular name, that particular issue. So the original jurisdiction is there, but it's the appellate jurisdiction which makes the court. Now, any case coming from the state courts does not go directly to the Supreme Court of the United States unless the state courts have all been utilized. In other words, appeal from state decisions. If you can raise a federal issue, which you can't always, if you can raise a federal issue, you must go through the state Supreme Court, and then it will go directly to the United States Supreme Court. That is the pathway. If it's a state case, for example, if you kill your wife, that's obviously a state issue, you see. That will be settled by the case. Those cases don't come up. However, if she didn't get proper counsel and the laws of the state didn't provide relief, then, you know, she can claim federal law. And the reason she can do that now is because the Supreme Court of the United States, in a series of decisions between 1926 and 1980-something, declared, and were largely due to Justice Cardozo's jurisprudence for that and Justice Black, the court declared that the Bill of Rights, which begins with what word? Congress shall make no law, you see. That really means, said the court, Supreme Court, that really means it reaches the states as well. But it took them 70 years until they bracketed almost all the provisions of the Federal Bill of Rights. There's still some that are out that the federal courts will not handle. For example, they don't have to give you a grand jury if they don't want to do it. That's an exception. There's a $20 fee in certain civil cases. They don't have to do that. But the great big Bill of Rights issues, you know, freedom of speech, and press, worship, assembly, and so forth, they've all been nationalized. And we owe that nationalization to Justices Cardozo and Black and a few others. That is also a very controversial issue, you see, because the justice who followed Chief Justice Marshall, who's also been regarded as a great justice, although not in the upper brackets, that was Taney, Chief Justice Taney, the author of one of the most outrageous decisions probably in our annals, namely Dred Scott versus Sanford, which established the presence, the constitutional presence of what? Slavery, right? Well, the irony is that Chief Justice Taney, he was the fifth Chief Justice. Chief Justice Taney had freed his slaves 30 years prior to Dred Scott versus Sanford. But he was trying to save the country from a civil war. And so he wrote Dred Scott versus Sanford, which denied citizenship and all the rights there under to the Negro, you see. Now, that meant that he had tried very hard to stem the tides of the Civil War, but he helped to bring it on. He was a very unhappy man. Although he did some interesting things which are not very legal, He was the first Catholic Supreme Court justice. His wife was an Episcopalian. They decided to talk about having children. They wanted to decide what denomination the children would be expected to pursue. So here's what they did. If the children were females, they would be Episcopalians. If they were males, they would be Catholics. They had seven children. They had six girls and one sickly boy. So that was the decision, you see. So Tawney is known for that. He has a statue in Baltimore. And during the past few years of burgeoning, constantly increasing civil rights movements, a large group of Baltimoreans wanted to tear down the statue of Tawney because of Dred Scott v. Sanford. The compromise was, all right, he can stay there, but we're going to have one for Thurgood Marshall also. So they're both there now. They're both happy, you see, whether they know it or not.
Two related questions. Is this on?
Yeah,
okay.
Close.
All right. What is the history, given the First Amendment, we have a right to free speech, what is the history of equating money with speech? Because it seems to me free speech means I can talk.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean I have the ability to put an unlimited amount of money into anything.
Well, that's a good question, and we have a...
And one related one with all that, right. And that has to do with corporations. When did they start being considered people?
They became people out of a case in Delaware. You know, Delaware has no taxes to speak of, and the corporations are having a ball in that state. There was a case involving a railroad, Santa Clara something or other, in the last quarter of the 19th century, when corporations, hooray, hooray for them, became people, became persons. Now, in legal contemplation and in legal language, I don't know where they got that from, you see, but it's here. They are. They have the same right as you and I.
Well,
you see.
I understand it was a clerk who actually put that language in.
Maybe so, you know, I don't know. That may be lore, but clerks are... By the way, the justices, as I think you all know, have very, very bright clerks. The first justice to have a clerk was Justice Horace Gray, who needed help. So out of his own pocket, he paid them a rather nice stipend. Congress finally provided clerks. They each get four clerks now. The chief gets five. Roberts doesn't want five. He gets four. And Stevens didn't even want three at one time. But these are the finest and brightest law students. They will tell you so, you see. And their future is assured because they're going to make a lot more money than Supreme Court justices, you know. And so the court, in trying to defend itself, ex-clerks may not argue before the court for a period of 2 years. It used to be for a period of 3 years, but those clerks had a good lobby. And so it's now locked down to 2 years. So the average clerk going out into the corporate law world will begin with something like 400,000, 500,000. Supreme Court justices get 200,000. I mean, that's a nice sum. In the academic world, we didn't make that kind of money, you know. Certainly not as much as football coaches make. And football coaches make so much money because they have such excellent results, you see. So that's why. All right. What about what? Oh, that's new. That's fairly new. It's not completely new. There was a famous case which rendered 28 opinions. Now, how could any case render 28 opinions? Partial concurrence, partial dissent, you see. Concurrence, judgment, etc. I finally really stopped teaching that case, which drove me up a wall, you know, and the students were delighted, you know. That case is still an issue because they distinguish between expenditures and contributions. It was okay to harness expenditures, but not contributions, you see. So that's, no, I'm sorry, I got it upside down. That happens. Expenditures, you know, would have to run the gamut. But contributions were different, you see. So now that's going to have to be changed sooner or later, you know, because both of them involve money. There's a whole slew of new books out which deals with money and politics. One of the Ali courses is taught by an ex-PhD of mine, I think. He has one called Money and Politics or something like that. I'm not too interested in that. I mean, I'm interested in the legal issues, but I don't know what you do all semester with that. But anyway, it should be regulatable, you know. First Amendment has become very large, you see, but it is in the Constitution. And you can't change the Constitution easily or readily, you know, you may be certain.
In the last couple of days, the Supreme Court declined to take a case on a Texas law that was requiring transvaginal ultrasound for women seeking an abortion. What is the effect when the Supreme Court does not take the case and just leaves the opinion stand from an appellate court at the state level or wherever?
When it doesn't take the stand, the highest decision below will govern. I'll give you an example which some of you may well have become familiar with. We have a very important case in the dockets coming from Michigan. The citizens of Michigan voted recently to forbid the consideration of race in admissions policies in the public schools. It was limited to racial considerations for admissions in public schools. The state of Michigan enacted such a law. The people of Michigan approved it 55-45. The case came to the Supreme Court. By the way, the court doesn't have to take anything. That's not entirely true, but for better or for worse, trust me, they can get out of almost anything. Anyway, the court did take that case. I heard the oral argument, and that is where Justice Kennedy made that stupid remark, you know, which I mentioned earlier today. Now, if the court, and that's possible, votes 4-4, because Justice Kagan had to recuse herself, she helped to support a tack of the law while she was Solicitor General of the United States. And the United States is interested in the case, of course, and is against what Michigan did. So she had to recuse herself. And by the way, it is up to them to determine whether or not they should recuse themselves. Lower court judges must obey a certain law, but the Supreme Court is sui generis. They don't. If they wanted to recuse themselves, okay. If not, okay too. So that case, there's a good chance that it'll end 4-4. Now, what does that mean? And you stated the question very well. It means that the highest decision below will govern. And that would mean that the Michigan law would fall, you see, because the highest court below, the Sixth Circuit Court of United States Appeals, you see, voted to strike the law. So that would mean that the highest decision below will govern. So that will respond to your question. And that's not a satisfactory decision from my point of view, because there was really no decision, you know. But those are the rules.
Most people didn't live to be 80 or 90 back in 1787. Since lifespan has increased a lot, there's been a lot of talk lately about changing the way the Supreme Court is structured. And instead of having an indefinite appointment with good behavior, someone is suggesting, I think it came out of the Mann and Ornstein book last year, of having a term being a finite length of 18 years, and the president would get to appoint one person every 2 years. So in a four-year term, a president would get two appointees, and they would obviously be staggered, and you would not serve indefinitely. You would serve for 18 years. What do you think of the value of that and the feasibility of structuring it that way?
Well, I wouldn't like it. You know, I don't like monkeying with the court. I also don't like monkeying with the current provision, which is residency on the court after appointment for good behavior, which means life. I don't want to see that change. I also don't want to see an alteration in the age limit. There are a lot of people who, and I respect, respect their feeling. A lot of people who want to put limits on the age level, you see, such as, for example, no one should see the Supreme Court after 75. Some states have that. And by the way, that those laws have been attacked, but they've been upheld. You can, you as a legislature can require that, you know. So I wouldn't be comfortable in fooling around with that. It's an interesting decision. There are a lot of people who comment on changes for the court. Your fellow citizen of Charlottesville, Larry Sabato, has written a big book about that. He practically wants to do away with the Supreme Court, you see. That. Try it. No, it's not going to happen. But those are all interesting issues. The age limit is a reasonable, I suppose. But if we had an age limit now, for example, we would have lost, let's say at 80, we would have lost Holmes, we would have lost Brandeis, we would have not Marshall, he was young. But we would have lost Stevens, you see, we would have lost Field. So is that really worth it? Now, there's a problem, but we have a 25th Amendment now. If they're senile, but how do you determine senility? I have students who are senile. That depends. My doctor tells me some spots on my arm are known as senile spots. So anyway, how do you determine that? Well, they've tried, but it's very difficult. In fact, there was a committee once that tried to Justice Stephen Fields off the court. He was out of it. He slept most of the time. He had had 34 years on the bench. He was a very fine jurist, the first one west of the Mississippi, but it was time for him to go, but he didn't want to go. Well, the Chief Justice, I think it was Taft, established a committee which included Justice Harlan, wonderful man, by the way, the grandfather of the Harlan you might have read about, a committee to seize Justice Fields and see what they could do to get him to step down. So they went to see him, and Harlan said to, woke up, he was sleeping, he woke up Field and said, Steve? Steve said, hello. And Harlan said, there's something we want to talk to you about. Well, what is it? Do you remember a few years ago when you were on a committee that wanted to see Justice Greer because he was senile and he couldn't follow things anymore? And Field said, stop right there. It was the dirtiest thing I ever did in my life. And now goodbye. So that's what's fine.
Next question.
I think, we'll have to make this the last question because I have a 3 o'clock appointment. Go ahead.
It's Bush v. Gore, yes. A decision which sticks in my craw and maybe a number of other folks here. I feel like it was probably wrong legally and morally, but at any rate, the hypocrisy of certain justices, and I'll use Justice Scalia as the poster boy, who purported to be strict constructionists and certainly did not portray that in that decision. Has that been more pronounced recently than, say, back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, or has it always been an issue that I'll portray myself as this and I'll vote on the court as that?
It's always been an issue, but now it's become more of an issue than it used to be. And every president who nominates people to be on the bench will ask his number one question, I trust you are a strict constructionist. Well, language, leaves a lot of open aspects. And strict construction is very nice, but, words are words, and I would not give a great deal of attention to that avowedness. You know, if they say that strict construction is fine, that's very nice of you. Now, I want to see them in action, you see. They are responsible people, and they know what their mission is. And by and large, I think they've really done pretty well. We could do much worse. It's an important, a significant body, and I'm happy it exists. And when I said earlier I'd give him a B+ or an A-, and thank President Madison for voicing that need, I would support that. Now, not every one of my colleagues would, but most people, when they think it through, what do you really want to substitute? on a group of congressmen, on a committee, or what? So, all right. Well, I thank you very much for your attentiveness. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.